Willkommen zu China Connect, dem Podcast des China Competence Training Centers. Mit freundlicher Unterstützung des Bundesministeriums für Bildung und Forschung.
Welcome to another episode of China Connect, your guide to research and transfer. My name is Oliver Hasse, and as always, I'm joined today by Isabel.
Hello, everyone. I'm really looking forward to this episode with a rather unusual topic for us, isn't it, Oliver?
Absolutely. We've looked at economy, we've looked at legal situation, we've looked at culture recently, but now we're also looking at psychology in China. And our guest today is Dr. Man Fang, affiliate scholar at the Research Institute for Sustainability at the Helmholtz Center Potsdam and founder of the Mindful Transculture Community. In her PhD research, she focuses on risk perception with an intercultural perspective and focuses on value ethics and moral concerns in risk governance. She has already been our guest in the previous episode called Cultural Insights. And if you haven't listened to that yet, I highly recommend that you do so. Man, welcome to our podcast again. Last time we spoke about culture. Culture in China and the differences between Chinese and German culture. But you're not only an experienced intercultural trainer and scholar, but you're also a trained psychologist and psychotherapist. And you have extensive experience in risk governance in China. We'll come back to that later during the episode. Your career started with studying psychology in China. How did you choose this subject?
Hi, great to see you again, Oliver and Isabella. Yeah, to this question, it was driven purely by my curiosity about people. So during my school days, my grades were good at the time, and then my parents actually encouraged me to continue in natural sciences or engineering. So I originally studied auto engineering as an undergraduate. And I learned programming and spent lots of time disassembling and assembling engines. However, I gradually lost interest. It began to feel repetitive and somewhat uninspiring. So first I turned to philosophy out of my curiosity. And while browsing philosophy books, I discovered psychology on the same shelf. That moment changed everything. I realized that psychology spoke directly to my questions about human beings. And that was what I knew I had found the field I wanted to pursue.
How has the field of psychology evolved in China during the last decades? And are there any differences between China and Europe in this regard?
Yeah. So to this question, I have to do some research, of course, and also according to my memories that I was growing up with the development of psychology in China. So psychology as a discipline in China has closely accompanied China's broader process of internationalization. So actually, strictly speaking, it began with an almost complete adoption of Western models and theories, and only gradually moved through phases of adaption, critical reflection, and eventually integration. One early milestone I want to mention dated back to around 1929, when a psychology department was established at Furen Catholic University in Beijing. So the first chief professor was Joseph Goetz. He was a German scholar and a student of Wilhelm Wundt, the founder of experimental psychology. So this lineage later influenced what is now Beijing University. So it's also the place where I graduated. I got my doctorate degree there, but from the Department of Public Policy. So back to our topic. At that time, however, many psychology textbooks used in China were translated not directly from Western languages, but from Japanese sources. So due to war and the internal political turmoil, the academic center of psychology shifted southward from Beijing and the Nanjing in the middle of China, then to Taiwan. Also, Cultural Revolution led to a near complete interruption of psychological research and training on Chinese mainland. It was not until the late 1970s and 1980s that psychology gradually recovered. So during this period, many psychologists from Taiwan traveled to mainland to teach and exchange knowledge, offering crucial support to their mainland colleagues. So it was also during this time that a significant movement toward the indigenization or so-called localization, 本土化 in Chinese, emerged in Chinese-speaking societies. This movement was initiated in the 1970s by the Taiwanese psychologist Yang Guoshu, and was widely supported by psychologists, anthropologists, and sociologists in mainland China and also Hong Kong. The core concern was a growing awareness that although the subject of study was Chinese society and the Chinese people, however, the theories and methods employed were mostly entirely Western. So as Professor Yang famously observed, in everyday life, we are Chinese, but when we conduct research, we become Westerners. So this narrative mainly reflects the development of academic psychology. The history of clinical psychology and psychotherapy in China followed a somewhat different path. In 1976, also a German psychology student, so we have lots of connections between German and China in terms of psychology, actually. A psychology student whose name is Margaret Haas Wiesegaard came to Beijing with the support of a DARD scholarship. At the time, there were only about 60 psychiatrists across the entire Chinese mainland. Through sustained collaboration between Chinese and German professionals, and by carefully navigating culture and political sensitivities, the first joint psychiatric seminar was held in Kunming. And actually, it's about psychoanalysis. This initiative supported the rebuilding of Chinese psychiatry and later evolved into what is now widely known as Sino-German training program. It's called Zhongdeban, one of the most influential programs for training psychiatrists and psychotherapists in China. So this program represents a milestone in the history of Chinese clinical psychology. Subsequently, with support from the German government and the civil society organizations, the first non-governmental Sino-mental hospital was established in Wuhan. So where is my hometown? Also, my earnest psychoanalytic training took place there. At present, China's diagnostic system is largely aligned with international standards, drawing primarily on the European International Classification of Disease, ICD-10, and the American so-called DSM-5TR.
So there are a lot of so-called Western influences, as you explained to us. How do Chinese cultural values, for example, collectivism, family roles, and the concept of faith influence psychological treatment and research in China?
Yeah. So faith and favor actually is one of the most important issues in the localization movement of Chinese psychology. It's rooted in Confucian ethics and has a history of thousands of years in East Asian society with a far-reaching influence. So as we discussed last time, relationships are considered a given in Chinese society. Whether we actively maintain them or not, they are always there. So this can be both blessing and curse as well. When the self is largely defined through relationships, individual psychological difficulties are often experienced as part of a broader relational system. Most commonly, the family or the immediate social context. Therefore, understanding patients often requires a systemic perspective, including attention to family roles and responsibilities. In many cases, it may feel more accessible for clients to talk about their duties and obligations before they can comfortably explore and name emotions, because maintaining harmony is often highly valued in families. Emotional distress may not be expressed directly. Therapists, therefore, need to be attentive to somatic symptoms, which frequently carry relational and emotional meaning. Physical complaints are often more readily reported than explicitly negative emotions. In some Western settings, distancing from parents can be seen as one possible way of establishing autonomy, whereas in Chinese context, this may generate, trigger lots of considerable inner conflict. Practices such as boundary setting or individualization, often emphasized in Western therapy, can therefore bring additional anxiety or guilt, especially when they are perceived as threatening relational continuity. Clinically, this suggests the importance of working carefully with internalized family relationships, rather than moving too quickly toward confrontation or independence. So the concept of face, we say, 我给你面子, I give you face, can be understood as an ethical orientation toward preserving dignity and mutual respect within relationships. So it emphasizes setting boundaries in ways that remain considerate of others and the social context, rather than focusing exclusively on individual needs. So from a therapeutic perspective, this highlights the value of addressing psychological difficulties at a systemic level or more complex level. It also helps explain why systemic and family-orientated approaches have found strong resonance in Chinese clinical practice.
So are there psychological conditions or stressors that present differently in China compared to Europe or the US?
Yeah. I would like to answer this question using the game Simple Exercise observed across different groups. So I often use an exercise called naming emotions, where participants stand in a circle or sitting in a circle and take turns one by one just to name an emotion. So to speak one word about emotions, but in a way, one relatively positive and then another one relatively negative. When I did this exercise with American colleagues, they were able to generate more than 20 within several minutes. For me, that was a moment of cultural surprise. In contrast, when I did the same exercise with Chinese group, there's often someone who struggles to name any emotion words at all. And we, as German students, I feel it's quite in between. I have observed a pattern that they turned to respond faster than Chinese participants while showing more bodily engagement during the exercise. So this are, of course, subjective observations rather than scientifically validated findings, and I would welcome more systemic research on this. However, one possible explanation relates to the language and expression is I feel Western cultures tend to emphasize verbal articulation, sometimes relatively independent of lived experience. In contrast, the Chinese written language is pictographic, so it's images, and naming an emotion often triggers images, visual, and also bodily associations. In addition, verbal expression in Chinese culture often carries a moral and a relational sensitivity, like we mentioned last time. So in group settings, people may be cautious about expressing negative emotions out of consideration for others, because others might share the emotional space. Coming back to psychological stressors, I think it's important not to overgeneralize. Individual experience always vary. That said, one pattern I noticed after moving to Europe is the prominence of burnout. Before coming here, I was familiar with concept mainly through media, like TV series or films, but it was rarely discussed in my clinical training in China. However, in Europe, colleagues often openly describe experiences of burnout, which helped me understand it more concretely. More recently, I have also begun to hear similar experiences among overseas Chinese and even inland mainland Chinese clients, particularly those with international or Western-oriented work and study backgrounds. Overall, these differences suggest that psychological conditions are not necessarily different across cultures, but they may become visible, named, and experienced in cultural-specific ways.
So you mentioned just now how people in Germany very openly talk about burnout or similar conditions. Actually, going back maybe 2-3 decades, mental health issues were very stigmatized in Germany. But I feel like it's a rather recent change that people now quite often and openly mention that they're going to therapy. How is it in China? I mean, is it socially acceptable to seek therapy for mental health issues?
Same. Yeah. So briefly speaking, it's increasingly socially acceptable to seek therapy for mental health in China. And in this respect, it's not fundamentally different from Western countries. Public awareness and openness around mental health have grown significantly in the past decades, especially among younger and urban populations, I have to say. One key difference, however, lies in the insurance and the healthcare system. In many Western countries, therapy is at least partially covered by public or private insurance, which makes access more feasible. In China, psychological therapy is often paid out of pocket, and insurance coverage is limited or inconsistent. This significantly influences who can seek therapy and how long they can afford, rather than social acceptance itself being the main barrier.
So if people then go and seek therapy or psychological treatment, what are the common methods?
Overall, before the 1970s and the 1980s, if I could generalize, psychological research and practice in China were largely shaped by Western models. Until today, major approaches such as Freudian psychoanalysis, Jungian depth psychology, and cognitive behavior therapy, so-called CBT, continue to develop in close alignment with international trends and remain among the most mainstream forms of psychotherapy in China. Within psychoanalysis itself, more differentiated traditions are also well represented, including client psychoanalysis, objective relations theory, ego psychology, self psychology, interpersonal psychoanalysis, or intersubjective system theory, and Lacan psychoanalysis, even among others. I once joined a Lacan group, and mostly I met artists. So different groups of people also are attracted by different approaches. At the same time, a wide range of other established and contemporary therapeutic approaches have gained strong popularity in China as well, like Gestalt therapy, family therapy, both based on Satya mode, or Munich family therapy, and co-creative expressive art therapy, and also dance movement therapy, and emotion-focused therapy, EFT. Over the past two decades, through clinical training and practice, I have personally experienced the rapid and the dynamic development of psychology in China. I've been in this area for more than 20 years, since my early 20s. Many founders of these approaches or their closest students have been invited to China to teach and train professionals. I often feel that I have had the privilege of witnessing and participating in a period marked by remarkable people and the formative moments. Another important development in recent years is the growing interest in body awareness-based therapists. So I have mentioned a lot before, like Feldenkrais, and even Alexander techniques now offered through more systemic training programs. However, it's still the case that most of the widely recognized and the popular programs are led primarily by Western teachers. If we are to speak of distinctive difference, it lies in the growing effort toward local integration, like bentuhua. This is most visible in the way how traditional Chinese medicine practices, such as tuina massage, like gua sha, and also dietary therapy within TCM framework. And it's all based on Taoist cultivation practices, also including martial arts and tai chi, are increasingly being combined with modern psychological concepts. In parallel, a growing number of professionals who are trained in both sides, clinical psychology and also traditional Chinese medicine, are experimenting with more organic forms of integration between these traditions.
In Europe, the US, diagnoses such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and anxiety are increasing, especially among young people. Some argue that this reflects greater openness to seeking help and improved professional expertise. However, others believe it stems from broadened diagnostic criteria and the fact that even mild cases are often being classified. There's also a debate about whether receiving a diagnosis has, for some people, become more appealing, for example, due to social media trends. Are similar discussions taking place in China, and do you observe comparable developments there?
Yeah, in China, especially in, we say, the first tier cities, most modernized and industrialized cities and areas with abundant educational resources, the following phenomenon are becoming increasingly common, as you have just shared with us. The proportion of children and adolescents suspected or diagnosed with ADHD is rising. The frequency of use of labels such as anxiety disorder, depression, and social phobia has increased significantly among university students or young adults or even teenagers. Common discussions among psychiatrists therapists, counselors, and school mental health professionals. Like, is the boundary between emotional distress and the mental disorder blurred? Or are academic pressure, family conflict, and the social competition being over-medicalized? And also, have diagnostic labels replaced the understanding of developmental stages and the social contexts, just like Max Weber has addressed long before, that sometimes the mental illness could be institutionalized. So for Chinese, a very typical tension arises from this side. On the one hand, parents worry that labeling their children will negatively impact their future. On the other hand, diagnosis can bring practical benefits within the education system, such as deferred exams, adjusted homework, or even special care from the teacher. This makes diagnosis in certain situations gradually acquire instrumental and strategic significance, thereby raising concerns at the ethical and educational levels. While diagnosis can bring understanding, of course, it remains strongly linked to shame, family reputation. So it's also about mien, it's the face, and anxiety about the future. Therefore, the trend in China is not simply enhanced diagnostic identity, but rather a paradoxical state. The tension between using psychological diagnostic language in private and striving to appear normal, like pretend I'm okay in public, may actually increase the individual's mental burden. And nowadays, these short video platforms, Xiaohongshu, like this Little Red Book, a WeChat channel in Bilibili, those Chinese platforms are disseminating a large amount of psychology content. While reducing stigma, this also brings the risk of self-labeling and the rapid self-diagnosis. So it's carrying a hidden function. It's not that I'm not trying, it's that I'm having difficulties. So this is not falsehood or deception, but rather an illustration that when society lacks tolerance for failure, vulnerability, and then diagnosis becomes the only acknowledged or legitimated pain.
Thank you very much. Let's switch topics slightly for the last part of our podcast. Oliver already mentioned your background in risk management, and we've also learned that you are trained as a trauma therapist. Could you tell us a bit more about your work in this area?
Oi. Yeah, of course. So it's like a past life and also a very profound life of my background. Risk governance and the emergency management were my areas of work from before the 2008 Olympics in Beijing until around 2015 when I left China, moved to Europe, first in France and then in Germany. So our main responsibilities in this area included assessing potential accident and disaster risks, developing emergency plans, and drafting policies that defined the responsibilities and the jurisdiction of governments at various levels. In terms of trauma intervention, on the other hand, is a specialized field entirely within clinical psychology. So it involves identifying people's reaction after a disaster or accident and providing them with psychological or mental care. Trauma intervention is a part of psychological support, which is in turn only one aspect of post-disaster assistance. So it's not entirety of emergency management. Once I participated in the compilation of a post-disaster psychological assistance manual for the Chinese Red Cross, which aimed to help all relevant personnel who were involving into the disasters or accidents understand the potential impact of accidents and the disasters on people. For example, after disaster, who will be affected? So in our common sense, it's the victims who directly influenced by the disasters, but actually their indirect influence also to those rescue teams, also to the managers who is working in the government, and also all those doctors and the nurses involved. So this work is about how we educated first the people that what are normal emotional reactions as a human being towards disaster and accidents, and how will these reactions occur at different times, and which reactions require professional psychological treatment. So this also includes differentiating between acute stress disorder and PTSD, which were known by us after 911, so that those who need psychological treatment can receive timely professional assistance. At the same time, we are also using these principles to replan the work of rescuers and the disaster managers so that they could maintain their health during emergency management, but not stretching them too much until they collapsed, because we had tons of lessons after the Wenchuan earthquake in 2008. And that is also a milestone how risk governance and emergency management has been developed so in the past years.
So you just mentioned the Sichuan earthquake in 2008. I believe you were there as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how trauma interventions are delivered in the immediate aftermath of events such as this earthquake or also floods in China, and who's typically involved?
Yeah, so this question really took me back into those memories of the years. I think this wound is still very present and still in the process of recovering until now. So after this, especially natural disasters, this includes the frontline rescue teams staff who are on site at the disaster site, also including commanders who is coordinating the resources and the transportations, which is very crucial during the rescue period. Of course, medical personnel and the media reporters, as well as NGOs providing professional assistance and technology support, such as geological exploration and assessment teams. And with the time goes on, and the responsibilities are also changing. So at the first place, it's always about rescue people or to give medical support for the people at the place, and also to support them with food and with clothes and with place to live. So that's also great learning for lots of psychologists and also psychotherapists, that we are not interrupting into these basic needs assistance at the first place. So actually, psychological assistance is a little bit coming afterwards. And so in terms of psychological first aid, it's including just very easily we are listening to the stories that how they are surviving from the disasters, and to hold the place for their feelings, whatever it is. And mostly we're not encouraged to raise so much questions, to speak so much. Sometimes we're just being with them, like open the water bottle for them, because people are really powerless at that moment. They are so fragile. Sometimes the words could be even harmful or disturbing for those like grief process, if they have lost their belongings, houses, also the beloved family members. And also we are trying to help them to back into the normal order of the life, like to get into sleep on time. You know, people might lose their normal sense of the time and the space. So the information sometimes is also very important for them to get into the normal sequence of the life. And so this takes normally 1 or 2 weeks. It's the first aid stage. And then we come into the early recovery period. It lasts for several weeks or several months, depends on individual. And we have to identify those people who is high risks. So it doesn't relate it specifically with how much they have lost. It really depends on what they feel subjectively. So during this time, we would organize some group activities so they could share in groups that what happened to them. So to be seen and to be heard, what they have experienced during those horrible disasters or accidents is very important. So if it's expressed, and then it's also healing process. And also some meditative guidance or just a meditation so that they could take it back to stabilize themselves when they cannot get into sleep, they have nightmares, or the disaster pictures or images flash back, they get easily triggered emotionally. So all this is diagnosed, and also it's a way that how we are accessing what they need. So maybe some people would need real treatment. And then it comes into the later period of recovery. So that means it's already several months or even after 1 year of the disasters. And most of the people, we would get healed with the time, but some people might get stuck into the loss or into this grief. And then we would provide professional assistance to them. And so there are different approaches like EMDR or CBT, mainly aiming on PTSD syndromes, so to say.
Thank you. You clearly have a lot of experience with a large-scale disaster response in China. So do you think there's something that German teams could learn from that?
Thank you. That's a very humble question. But actually, I think it's always a mutual learning. In general, the Chinese central government has a strong mobilization capacity. For example, during the Wenchuan earthquake, the central government was able to immediately coordinate national resources to provide aid to several severely affected areas, demonstrating strong leadership. While Germany has a very strong individual, or rather civil society and NGOs, its spontaneous organizational coordination and the professional rescue capacities are very high after large-scale disasters. That's what I have observed and also experienced. So in contrast, I've observed that in Germany, the voices of citizens and different political parties often influence the decision-making process, resulting in a relatively weaker ability for the government to integrate and coordinate resources, like the construction of train station in Stuttgart. So, however, it must be acknowledged that while Germany's decision-making speed is extremely slow, its execution efficiency is relatively high, I feel. China's efficiency depends entirely on the leaders. So the leadership of the implementers, leading to greater uncertainty, actually. This is because during the decision-making process, opinions and the feedback from relevant parties are not fully connected. But Germany is the other way around. So during this very slow process, everyone's voice has been heard. So in terms of carrying out. Everyone just following the items or the contracts or the plan. And everyone knows exactly what their responsibility is. So, yeah, so in this perspective, I feel it's really a mutual learning process. Of course, regardless of the government, the bureaucratic system suffers from the same problem, extreme slowness. Therefore, since the Wenchuan earthquake, the government has also begun to encounter the development of NGOs, especially civilian relief forces. Today, China's civilian search and rescue teams are a very important force after the disasters. I think this is also the inspiration from the Western civil societies, I have to say.
Thank you so much, Man, for giving us all of these insights into risk management and psychology in China. It was a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much as well for inviting me here and also integrating all those identities within me. And by expressing all this, it's also a process being heard and being understood. And I'm really grateful for this opportunity. And I'm very honored to be invited. Thank you, Isabella and Oliver, for this initiative.
Thank you very much.